2002 with a talk by Mr. George Dyson. I'm not sure it's happened before. Peter and Ames could probably tell me, but it's a special treat to have a father and son combination in our program, especially this father and son combination. Also with us tonight is a good friend of both. Please welcome UBC Professor Emeritus of Physics and an honorary life member of the Vancouver Institute, Dr. Eric Vogt. Eric? Our speaker tonight, George Dyson, is an author, boat designer, and historian of technology. His interests range from the history and prehistory of the Aleut kayak to the evolution of digital computing and telecommunications, and most recently to the nuclear bomb-propelled space exploration. I find it interesting that George Dyson avoided formal education. Interesting comment in an institution that we're at tonight. But he's done interesting things. For instance, during the 1970s, he spent 3 winters in a treehouse, 95 feet up in a Douglas fir on the shores of Indian Arm in Belcarra Park. And his kayak designs, resurrecting the Aleut Russian Badarka, have been built by thousands of followers. Also, his books have been well received, and you'd be interested in some of the quotes about them. James Michener praised Badarka as a grand, detailed book that will set the standard for years to come. And Oliver Sacks wrote that Darwin Among the Machines was a very deep and important book, beautifully written, and as remarkable an intellectual history as any I have read. Can you imagine a more sincere compliment than that, George? That's wonderful. Arthur C. Clarke described Project Orion as one of the most awesome might-have-beens or yet-may-bes of the space age, essential reading for engineers and scientists involved with government bureaucracies and the notorious military-industrial complex. George Dyson is a dual citizen of Canada and the United States. He's now a research associate at Western Washington University. He lives and works in a converted tavern on the industrial waterfront of Bellingham, Washington. Some things don't change, I assume, George. And he's not working on another book. Tonight he will speak under the title Project Orion, The True Story of the Atomic Spaceship. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Mr. George Dyson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Is the sound level okay with this mic? When Arthur Clarke sent that quote, it was longer than that. He went on about missile defense, saying that the only rogue states that threaten the national security of the United States were the defense contractor states, California, Florida, and Texas or one of the others. So those are the rogue states we have to really worry about. So it's great to be here. I gave my first public talk here in this room in 1978. And in case there's anyone in the audience who was there, I'm going to start off with that to explain how, I'm not just coming to this cold. Why am I telling you now about this atomic spaceship stuff, which is quite implausible, but important from the sense that the people who did this are disappearing. These are the last few years of their life, and that's why I thought it was important. I spent the last 4 years tracking these old guys down who worked on this project and recording it, which is what I did also with kayaks. I came to Vancouver in 1970. I thought my older sister Katarina would be here in the audience. She and I came up here for her wedding, and so that's me at age 17 in 1970. I started building kayaks here in Kitsilano, and went on from there, just becoming more and more interested in the history of who were the people who built these boats and how much of this knowledge was unrecorded and disappeared and could only be reconstructed in part later by trying to build these things again, which is what I did, was take these old designs and rebuild them and try and learn what it was like in the old days. And I envisioned that this whole coast was empty then. There were no kayaks. Now, of course, it's full of kayaks. So that sort of happened. the kayak came back. I was able to do those crazy things thanks to the hospitality of the people of Vancouver, in particular the Greater Vancouver Regional District, who owned, or didn't own yet, but were about to own the land, which is now Belcarra Park, then was Crown land. I built my house 95 feet up in that tree, and nobody complained or caused me any trouble, and I lived there happily for all those years while I did this research. My brother-in-law, Jason, let me use his UBC library card, is where I did most of my research. And without really the hospitality of this community of Vancouver, none of this stuff would have happened. I would have had to get a real job and lost all my imagination. These two children are Peter Thomas's children. Peter Thomas ran the film biomedical lab right here at Woodward, and all these slides were processed right here in this building, again, through his generosity when there was no way I could otherwise get film processed, and these children are now grown up. And so my craziest thing was to build this enormous, huge kayak, a kayak that was 48 feet long, and it really answered the question of why didn't people in the old days build kayaks that big. It just didn't make sense. But the spruce was cut up on Hanson Island, on the inside coast of Vancouver Island, and this was built and launched out in Belcarra Park. And the guy with the notebook in his back pocket right above the dog is Kenneth Brower, and he's smiling and happy because he's writing a book where this kayak is sort of one of the icons in his story. So all these people, all those kids are now, they've got their own kids, they've got grandchildren. This is off Stanley Park coming around to Jericho for Habitat Forum, which was, I think, 1975. So this boat sort of never succeeded as a boat. It went up around Vancouver Island once or twice, but it really didn't make sense. It wasn't really a yacht, and it wasn't really a kayak. But it became the focus of Ken's book, where he contrasted this huge kayak with this bizarre plan to build an atomic bomb-propelled spaceship. And so he spent months interviewing me about and going on the kayak trip with me, and then he spent months with my father and some of the other people who worked on that spaceship. And at that time, things were still very deeply classified. He couldn't get much information about the Project Orion, which was the project to build this interplanetary ship. But the book went on and on and on. Someone just brought me a copy to sign, and it was the 19th printing. So it had this ongoing life, which doesn't really give any sense of the reality. I mean, it's sort of a very much not fictionalized, it's true, but it's a sketch of what happened. A British edition where they took the cover off an L.L. Bean catalog. So it has really no resemblance to reality. This is the Korean version that has wonderful illustrations. And this is mainland Chinese, just came out last year. So life of its own, but it didn't give the whole picture. So what I did was I kept building kayaks for years and years and years. I kept working on these, building fleets of them, taking trips to Alaska, living in the wilderness. But all the time, you know, in the back of my imagination, one of the things that propelled this was having grown up with my father really planning to go out and live in space. And so these landing on some of these islands up the coast were like foreign planets. It really was a different universe out there. And so my first book was explaining all that, to put it in real pictures and quoting the historical sources to give the history of these boats. And then that book was sort of got my foot in the door. So the next book was this book that did the same thing that I had done for kayaks, but doing it for computers. It again annoyed me that people seem to think computers were invented 10 years ago when people first heard about them. They go back a lot further. So this book takes sort of the history of computing back to the 17th century. And it did fairly well, did well enough, particularly in England with Penguin, So the penguin said, well, what do you want to do next? And that's when it became clear to me, this was 4 years ago, that, and now we're back, we're done with the introduction, that the next story I wanted to get down was the people who worked on this spaceship project. Before they died, they'd never been able to talk about this because of the classification problems. So I spent the last few years tracking them down, tape recording, digging out. It's essentially the worst time in 30 years to get anything declassified since the problem with Wen Ho Lee at Los Alamos. But friendly people in the Air Force in various places sort of released enough stuff to me so I could put a little piece here and there and get the whole story. So that this is a title frame from a test film. This Project Orion was the first project funded by ARPA. ARPA is sort of the people who brought us most recently the internet, but the first $1 million check they wrote was to start Project Orion. And this was the film prepared by the project people for the ARPA sponsors, where they had built a flying explosive propelled model. We'll see more pictures of it, and that's the title frame. And the precedent for this really goes straight back to Jules Verne. The first science fiction space story was to send this spaceship to the moon, and it was sent by gunpowder. It was sent through explosions. It wasn't sent like a rocket that, you know, sort of continuous combustion. So that's Jules Verne's ship. And this is 1956. My mother right here in the front row took this photograph. So that's Esther, my sister, sitting on my father's lap, and I'm sitting beside. This is in Berkeley. So this is the year that nuclear fission was declassified for commercial purposes. You could first time declassify the designs of fission reactors. And my father, Freeman, there, got a job designing and building a reactor. And then the same people who built that reactor in 1956, the next year, when Sputnik went up and everybody got upset, what are we going to do? The Russians are ahead in space. Ted Taylor, my father's partner on the reactor, said, let's build an atomic-powered spaceship. And they did it at a place called General Atomic, which is this fabulous facility. It still exists. It's now privately owned in La Jolla, California. The central building in the middle there is the library. The idea was that all the disciplines would be, there wouldn't be a chemistry library and a physics library. There would be one library, and everybody worked out of the same library. It worked very well. That central library is 135 feet in diameter, 40 meters. It happens to be exactly the size of the ship they were planning to build, was that size. This is Ted Taylor, the man who led and organized the project, pushed just tirelessly for 7 years to try and build this thing. That's him in 1999. So the ship was going to be that big, but about 200 feet high. And that gives you a sense of scale. That's sort of be the level of the first level of shock absorbers. There you get a picture of what, this is the ship, one of those ships landed on Mars. There's two more in the backgrounds in orbit. But so if you can imagine that building, but that high, sort of the height of a 20-story building. Lots of very good physicists worked on this, and they mainly came out of the, not so much the atomic bomb program, but the hydrogen bomb program. During the war, it was very exciting at Los Alamos to build the first set of bombs, and then it got kind of boring, and then Edward Teller and other people pushed very hard for the hydrogen bomb, and things got very exciting again. And then by 1956, the hydrogen bomb work was essentially done, and it was boring again. So when Project Orion came along, a lot of these hydrogen bomb people, like Marshall Rosenbluth and Ted Taylor, they went to work on Orion, and they were just the right people because the problem of directing the energy to move this ship was very similar to the problem of focusing the energy to cause a thermonuclear explosion. The plaque here on the rock is a monument to Frederick de Hoffman, who was the entrepreneur who started General Atomic and really made this whole thing happen. He's the guy who said, yes, you can spend our money, you can do it here, I'll get you the classified documents, you can try to build this thing. The idea goes back to a paper by Stan Ulam, a Los Alamos very good mathematician, who had the idea in 1946 right away, how could we propel a spaceship with bombs? He wrote this now declassified report in 1955. Nothing happened to it until Sputnik, when suddenly the government was running around, how are we going to catch up to the Russians? And a group was started called ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, and they wrote the first contract, 30th June 1958. They gave $1 million to the Orion people to start work on this thing. So the entire project ran for 7 years on one 23-page contract. I had a contract recently from NASA trying to get some photocopies back from me. It was a 37-page contract for them to pay me 7 cents a page to get some of their own documents back. That's why we're not going into space anymore. And everything's stuck on the ground. So at the beginning, the thing was totally black, top secret. No one could know the name. No one could even know it was happening. On July 1st, 1958, ARPA allowed the existence of the project to become known. And then this telegram went out from my father to a physicist in Geneva: spaceship project officially begun, job waiting for you. So the thing, finally they could hire people. At that time they had about 12 people working for them, and it grew. And then the next, so that was July 3rd. July 5th, my father sat down and wrote a Space Traveler's Manifesto, which starts off, either through inadvertence or by a deliberate act of wisdom, the American government has announced to the public that we are working on the design of a spaceship to be driven by atomic bombs. So that was his, and then he spent 5 pages sort of explaining why it was important to go out into space big time, large scale. And right away, they started producing this tremendous body of literature. Frederick de Hoffman was an academic, and he liked reports, so anytime anybody had an idea, they would write it up. This is August 20th, 1958, trips to satellites of the outer planets. And this was only declassified last, a few years ago. Why stuff like this is still kept classified is completely ridiculous, as if the Taliban are going to build 4,000-ton spaceships or something. There's no reason other than the fact that it mentions the word bombs. There's nothing threatening in most of these reports. And here we have the characteristics of the outer planet satellites. So these people were immediately very serious about where they would go and had good reasons for going there. Places like Jupiter and Saturn are too big to land on, but the satellites are very good. There's less gravity, you can land, you can get propellant to go there and come back. And we can see the dimensions of the ships. We're talking about very large ships. The small-sized ship, note the wood pusher plate. They're actually serious about using wood as the coating for the plate that basically gains momentum from the explosion. And wood is actually quite good because it doesn't conduct heat as much. Metal will actually disintegrate quicker than wood. So they were serious at the beginning about using a wood pusher plate, which sounds crazy now. And so satellite is a small ship with about 300 tons. It's the size of a fully loaded 747 or something. Orion, which was sort of the classic thing they were going to build, is 2,000 tons, and then Super Orion is 8 million tons. So this is that no real serious work was done on that, but it was looked at the beginning. And here is, again, only declassified last year, a picture of the original 4,000-ton design. It's basically a big dome where the people would be living up in the top. There was going to be a cafeteria with windows and a recreation area. That's how they would spin the ship to produce artificial gravity. And then all these things you see layered there are about 2,000 sort of 5-kiloton yield, very crude sort of early 50s style fission bombs that would be spun out from the side through these strange launching mechanisms. There you can see, so they're like, it's sort of basically like a giant Gatling gun that would release these things. The pulse rate was 4 per second, so you had to have 4 explosions per second to get this thing off is that this time it was going to lift right from the surface of the earth. It wasn't built in space. It was actually launching from Nevada or maybe from a barge out in the ocean. This is the bomb launching mechanism that launches these things. And for this, they brought in consultants from Coca-Cola who worked on vending machines. It's the same problem of getting the right, you have to have the right flavor at the right time. Because if you have one dud bomb, then the next one has to be a half yield charge or you'll get out of phase. So lots of complicated mechanical work. Here you can see sort of the different ideas they were looking at is how to get the bombs launched. If you push them through the middle, then you have this hole in your pusher plate that has to be protected. If you go around the side, what happens if you have a dud? So there was a constant sort of reworking of ideas on this. Random walk of trajectory due to bomb misplacement. So you have a bomb that, you know, its timing is a little off and it's a bit further than it should be when it goes up and your ship starts veering off, what happens? It turned out it was possible to stabilize the ship quite easily. So no matter what happened, it would stay on course. Here we have the real hard numbers. Again, this is the kind of thing that was not supposed to be declassified but slipped out. Someone just didn't notice that it came out. So for the 4,000-ton ship, the 135-foot diameter, the bomb yield is 5 kilotons. At the surface, they're very, very smaller bombs because you're just sort of, the air is pushing, not, you need much less of a yield. You need 800 explosions to reach 300-mile orbit. So it takes about 5 or 6 minutes. You've got these two to four bombs per second, and then you're up in orbit, and you can safely cruise from there. And you get 800 tons to Mars orbit and return to Earth. And then the large version, the advanced interplanetary ship, 10,000 tons, you end up, the bottom line is you get 1,300 tons to Saturn and back. So that's enough to really take, you know, 50 people, 4 or 5 years worth of supplies. These are timetables for going to Mars and Venus. That was going to be the first trip. So if you look at the departure dates, they're talking about January 1961, August 1962, April 1964, November 1965. And the consensus was to aim for 1965. And all this was done by hand with slide rules. Almost no computers. The trajectory is figured out by people just working this out on graph paper. Half the guys on board probably would have been working on the navigation on paper. That was for Earth, Mars. So the problem was that ARPA wasn't really in this business. ARPA was set up to fund things and then not develop them. So who was going to develop this thing? The original plan was for NASA to develop it. ARPA's assumption was that they would fund the idea, and then NASA would come in and build it. NASA didn't want anything to do with it. From the very beginning, NASA said, we don't like this project. They tried to kill it. They consistently said no. So the people who took it on was the Air Force, a group at Kirtland Air Force Base, and you can see their little shoulder patch. They were the bomb people in Albuquerque, and they loved this idea, and they kind of took it and ran with it. There were a bunch of very dedicated physicists who, they wanted this thing for science. They wanted to go out and explore the outer planets and do this stuff. But the problem was, to keep funding it as an Air Force project, it had to have military applications. So they had to develop, they had to present this thing to the generals back in Washington, that we are developing a weapons system, a working weapons system, and step by step they would start with this 20-ton little test vehicle and start showing that this thing could be used. But what it would end up doing, nobody knew. This is a 200-ton test vehicle. So they came up with all these crazy ideas, some of which, again, which are now bits and pieces have got declassified. One was to put basically the doomsday weapon, a 1,600-ton hydrogen bomb out in orbit that could blow up half the Earth, and you just would have one button, and you wouldn't need all these fleets of missiles and stuff. You just had the one button. And this is what a report looks like when you finally get it declassified. And So you just get these little scraps here and there, but you can piece them all together and get the picture. So this is a 4,000-ton military version. No one will say what is in that big cargo area, but you can. The assumption is it's a very large weapon. And here we have a sketch that slipped out for. And this actually, I think, was a sensible idea. This was a program that ran quite seriously for several years to build an Orion deep space force. And so there would be a fleet, there would be about 20 of these ships out in orbit past the moon. And then if the Russians did anything inexcusable, you could call one of these ships in and release your missiles and destroy the bad guys. And the advantage of this is, what the problem is, that we barely survived. I think we don't know how close we came to real apocalypse during the 50s and 60s with the system we had, where we were on like a 20-minute hair trigger warning. So if there was a false radar signal that the Russians were attacking, we had to make a decision in 15 minutes whether to respond irretrievably, whereas these ships would have been 10 or 12 hours out. So you could have called in the retaliation and had 10 or 12 hours to change your mind and stop. And I think in reality, the system would have been a lot safer. And it would have been a lot more fun for the guys. Instead of living underground in these silos in North Dakota, they'd have been out, you know, looking at the Earth, like the whole Earth catalog, out in space. And they had quite serious plans. We're going to be blue and gold rotating crews, so you went out for 6 months or so. And then, as this project developed further, about year three or four, the key thing is the design of the propulsion unit. And this, again, is something that's deeply secret still and quite threatening. But this is how you build a very directional nuclear explosive. So it's not just a bomb that blows up in all directions. It's like a shotgun that shoots in a very narrow cone, and all the energy goes within a number of degrees that we're not supposed to know. And then you can build a much smaller ship and use much, much smaller bombs. And then the whole thing becomes much, much smaller. So these then become sort of the size of, not lunch boxes, but much smaller than oil drums, that kind of thing. And so the nuclear device is there, and then you have this little slab of propellant. So you're back behind the pusher plate there. It blows up, compresses this piece of tungsten to like four times its density, a very, very high temperature, and then that expands out towards the ship in a very directed way and stagnates against the ship and kicks it forward. And so then you can start doing that once a second or so and get a very tolerable impulse that's stretched out in time as well as space. So you get a smoother propulsion of the ship, and you can build a much smaller ship. So this was sort of their development plan at the time. They started in 57. They were working on all these things in parallel, and the idea was to really get the thing launched by 1965, and then the project got killed. Now we'll go to the next. So now we get into the real experimental stuff, where to convince the Air Force to keep doing this, the decision was made that they actually had to build a working model. So this model is 1 meter in diameter, weighs about 300 pounds, and it's driven by high explosives. Just like, so amazingly similar to the Jules Verne thing. It's uncanny. So this is 1958, 1959, and apologies, when I took these pictures off a digital tape, I left the mouse pointer and all. So the mouse pointer indicates nothing. One of the people I tracked down was an explosives engineer who had been a saboteur, and he was still alive, living in California. And it turned out he had taken these films, and when they were being destroyed, the security guard called him and let him take them home. So he had all this stuff in his garage. And so this is the first model. This is a little 1-foot model with a tiny little golf ball explosions, just to get some sense of how the shockwave scales around the corners and so on. This is the next model. So these are models just with one charge at a time, just to get a sense of how the thing would really jump rather than fly. And they did all this at Point Loma on a Navy base, right almost in downtown San Diego. The guy in front is Astle, the fellow who, the saboteur who did all the explosives work and took these, most of these pictures. The writing on the shell says danger, explosives inside. And a lot of failures. That's a film that shot at 4,000 frames per second of the thing completely blowing to pieces. So there's a very narrow window between charges that would be powerful enough to lift the ship up and not so powerful they blew it apart. And this was, I think, an absolute triumph of spirit for these guys to build this working model in 6 months, essentially, from the idea to successful flight. They got this thing to work. So you can see the charges are about, you know, about a kilogram of C4 high explosives. That's way, way more than that guy had in his shoes on the airplane. So that's one of the charges, a little sort of coffee can full of C4 high explosive. And now it's so bizarre how today we can't, you know, the argument is whether you can fly with your tweezers or your, you know, paper clip. And in those days you could just freely, they could go pick up 400 pounds of C4 at the local depot and work with it. So that's Ed Day, who was one of the, sort of led the experimental team. And just holding a coffee can full of high explosive without much concern. So all these charges were stacked up, and then you had to have this very, again, this is pre-solid state electronics, you had this very complex mechanical system to eject them at the right time. And that is sort of the whole gang. The guy in carrying the briefcase in the sport coat, that's my father, Freeman, who came down to watch these experiments on weekends. And they finally got the thing to fly. They went through a lot of models and a lot of failures. And finally, this is one of the first successful flights. It's launched out of a little tub. It goes up, and there's five or six of these charges. And so the whole point here was this didn't really have much relation to building a real ship, but it made a great film, and they could take this to the Air Force generals who would just go, wow. And they took it to Wernher von Braun in Huntsville, the rocket guy. And even Wernher von Braun he gave the thing full support. He really wanted this thing to go in the end because it was so exciting. And then they took the envelope off, the ballistic envelope, to make it a little lighter. And that's when the most successful flights were. They called this the hot rod that got up, did some beautiful flights. And they also did shock absorber tests. The cars give you a sense of the date. So this is early, or late 58, early 59. They're doing mock-ups of these big pneumatic shock absorbers that would have cushioned the explosion between the pusher plate and the ship. So you have a very complicated dynamic where you have two sets of shock absorbers. And so the ship is moving sort of like a jellyfish. It's not just one bounce. It's got a sort of a three-harmonic level. There's 4.5 oscillations of the lower pusher plate for every half oscillation of the upper one. And all that has to be perfectly tuned or it'll start shaking itself to pieces. So that's a diagram. What would it feel like to be a passenger? That's the acceleration you would feel in the crew compartment. And you see the where it says misfire condition. That's if there's a dud. So if you're cruising along, sort of whoomph, 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 and then one of the bombs is a dud, you go, ooh, it's like an airplane hitting a turbulence pocket. And then they fire a half momentum charge and get back to normal. And again, more detailed drawings of all the size. Quite again, they're getting smaller, but it's still 34 meters in diameter. It's a big ship, and the reason for that is is radiation shielding. These things don't really work small, because as you make the ship smaller, the radiation is, the shielding is exponential. So you really, if you have a small ship, you have to add all this weight just to shield yourself, and it stops, you kind of lose all the advantage. So this gives you dosages, which would be rather horrifying to people today. But in the 50s, this didn't look so bad. And there you can see kind of where they're coming in with the yield. I mean, you're talking about some large, 20 kiloton yield bombs. So these are sort of standard Hiroshima scale pulse units. And it would, the number of them would be quite, it would be, to go to Mars and back would be about 2,600. And then this was a very idealistic view of, which is really why, when people say, how were these guys crazy to be doing this scheme, what did they think? Didn't they think about radiation? They thought about radiation a lot. The fallout reports are still impossible to get declassified, but they believed very strongly that there would be, we were going to get clean bombs. So there where it says improved system, that's what everybody thought would happen, was that we were going to get very small bombs with almost no fission. And then there would have been very little radiation. And that actually was a good thing. I think it never happened, because we got the neutron bomb, but that was still up in the middle somewhere. It wasn't really clean. And I think if we'd had clean bombs, for instance, we would have used them in Vietnam and places like that, and it's a good thing we never got them. And then another minor problem, what happens to the people on the ground who are watching when the ship launches? So that's sort of what level of protection you need if you're watching an Orion ship flying overhead. And then another is a sort of silly crew compartment noise. There's in the final NASA finally supported the thing enough to do a feasibility study at the very end of the project, 1964. And in the final report to the government, there is 2 pages about fallout and 9 pages about crew compartment noise. So, and these are various sort of political problems. What happens if you have a launch failure? If either the whole ship blows up on, this is when they were going to try and chemically launch from the ground. And what if you have a sort of a space shuttle failure? Then you have the problem that, this is sort of PowerPoint of the time, the Air Force briefing flip charts, but if 1,000 bombs fall in the fire and all the high explosive detonates, you still don't get any nuclear explosion, but you do have a possible problem of burning plutonium. So this is really, as far as NASA was concerned, this is what killed the project. That you just couldn't, there were too many retired people living in Florida, and it just was politically unacceptable to take that risk. Even though you could reduce the risk to negligible, any risk was too much risk for NASA. So these were the ideas for launching the thing. It was no, even after 1958, it was clear you couldn't start off with bombs right from Nevada or even the South Pacific. You'd have to boost into orbit first and then start the bombs like that. And that got fairly far along, again, until it sort of became clear that NASA would just not do it. And this gives you the advantages. You sort of have a comparison this is again military stuff. For a military mission, if you want eight men to be out for 30 days with a 40,000 foot per second velocity change, that would be something like, going out and wiping out some Russians on the moon and coming back or something. The little Orion ship would do it, but it would take a huge chemical rocket. And if the Russians were on Jupiter, and you had to go to Jupiter with 30 men for 90 days and fight the bad guys, then the little tiny Orion would still do it, but the chemical rocket would be as big as the Empire State Building. So at the time when the sort of deep space force plans were happening, Orion looked extremely attractive, and that's really what supported it. And look at the cost there of this is payload to the moon, $70 a pound. I mean, our space shuttle is $10,000 a pound just to orbit. So the very, very optimistic view of costs. But the whole question, whether you could do this or not, depended on you had to do some tests. So there were lots of plans to how are we going to actually do one real test with one real bomb, which would sort of give the decisive answer to whether the thing would survive or not. There were plans for underground tests. Lots of tests were sort of almost into orbit. Tests underground where you put sort of half the ship in a big underground cave and use small bombs. This is a crazy scheme, again, developed by NASA. How can you test the thing completely with high explosives on the ground? So the entire ship is built upside down. And then you have this thing that's like a jukebox that spits out 1,500-pound disks of high explosive at one-second intervals, and they blow up and test the thing. And that would have, to me, that would have been harder to build than the ship itself. So this is NASA's final. Finally, when they funded a feasibility study, it produced this great long report that NASA released by accident without declassifying it. That's the stuff they were trying to get back from me. So they developed a ship, very serious, detailed plans for an 8-person ship that would go to Mars. Down to very nice, this is sort of drawings of the accommodations. And the interesting thing there is that if you look in the upper part, the furniture is right side up. And then in the big lower part, all the furniture is upside down. Like up top, there's chairs and then down below, there's a shower and there's desks and a workstation and a dresser drawers and stuff. And those are all upside down. Because when you were taking off, you would be in that upper shielded area. And then once you were on your way to Mars, the ship would spin and produce artificial gravity. And so all the furniture that was on your floor would then be on the ceiling. And this is sort of what they could do, 200 to 400, 450 a day trips to Mars with reasonably large payloads. I mean, still, it would be like a school bus compared to a Volkswagen, but it wasn't anything like the original Orion, which was really an ocean liner. And even versions that would barely make it to Jupiter. And you can see an equal number of astronauts and scientists. So the scientists still had their hand in there. They wanted to go. And you could work on the thing while you were traveling. You weren't just stuck sitting in a chair with seatbelts. You could get out and fix things. Everybody must have had fun drawing everybody sort of wanted to draw the bed they were going to sleep in. There you have Storm Cellar, which is actually, it turns out that you have as much problem with radiation from solar storms as you do from the bombs themselves. So any ship that's going to take 400 days to go to Mars has to be heavily shielded from radiation anyway. So you don't have to actually do much extra to shield yourself from the bombs. And then this is another non-declassified, shouldn't be public, real detailed schematic of how the bombs are ejected. They're in these little spiral magazines, and they come out, and then some artist conceptions of what the thing would look like. You don't really, in space, a nuclear weapon does not produce a fireball or anything. It's just a little flash, and you really don't see much until, because you have all this cold material around the bomb, and that moves out at high speed, and then only when it hits the ship, then it gets white hot again. So you have a flash against the bottom of the ship. That's replacing, tossing out the fuel magazines and doing some repairs on their way to Mars. And that's visiting Mars. We're going to take these sort of space shuttle-like craft that would land on Mars. And several ships would go together, so if you broke down, you could get spare parts from the other guy and so on. So the dream, it started off with a big splash and then it just slowly dwindled away. The government kept looking at this thing and looking at it and studying it, and every step of the way the obstacles got bigger and bigger and people realized it was never going to happen. There was a period in 64 when Kennedy, or 63, he started just before he was assassinated, there was an initiative to do this with the Russians, to have a cooperative effort with the Russians to build these ships and go to Mars using our nuclear stockpile together. And that was an interesting plan. And of course, it didn't get anywhere either. So 1965, June, we've got the final, all these endless government studies and reports, we've got the final objective to establish the inherent feasibility of nuclear impulse propulsion. Results, none. This project is hereby terminated. So that's the day, the moment the project was finally killed. And that is the end of it. And it sort of all went into lost in these archives, and the people who worked on the project went off to do other things. And every once in a while, there would be a glimmer. Somebody would try and revive the idea. And it turns out that when I started looking for stuff at NASA, it turned out that actually NASA has a secret little program now that's still looking at the idea, really for the question of asteroid defense. If we get the phone call tomorrow that the astronomers have seen something really large, the size of Vancouver, that's going to hit us in a year, what do we do? And NASA is very concerned that politicians will say, well, what about the plans for Orion? And that's why they were trying to get all the stuff back from me, because they threw it all out. And I had their last copy of those reports. And so it actually is still, that's really about the only thing it would be good for. If it's a life or death, you know, Earth is going to be destroyed by something large, it's conceivable somebody would say, this is really the only off-the-shelf existing technology that could deal with it if we're willing to accept those kinds of risks. And we have to be facing a terribly big risk in order to do that. But it's an interesting thing that it still has a life, and there's people at NASA who are passionate that this is what we should do, but they face the political obstacles. So that's the end. And any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
I will now open the floor for questions.
What you mean, launching the ship from the? Sir, no. The initial launch is really quite gentle. You start with very, very, very small explosions. I mean, of the order of a tenth of a kiloton or less. And again, with all this cold material around the bomb, and very directional, so you're not going to produce any crater at all. They were probably going to launch it from a barge, from a big steel barge, and the steel would have to be 4 inches thick or something, but it wouldn't take much more than that. And then they probably would catapult the thing up the first 200 feet or something to give it a bit of momentum. And then from there, the hard part was that you had to gradually increase the yield. So for the first like 100 explosions, they had to, you know, they had to be graduated in yield. They had to be in order. You couldn't, if one of them was out of order, it would screw things up. So, but that's all in the context of what was okay in the 50s time. It was like 1% of what was being blown up in the atmosphere every year anyway. But now, of course, it's just completely different. Yeah, I found a whole, Jerry Astle has boxes and boxes of them. He's got reels and reels. They have a little loop. They have the official version that went to ARPA. Huh, yeah, they should. I don't know. But the film is fabulous. I mean, the best part of the film, the Air Force film shows the success. The film that Jerry Astle has in his garage shows all the failures. And that's much more spectacular.
Eric? Yes, George. You've talked now to some of the pioneers, like Freeman Dyson and Ted Taylor and others who were involved. And
they devoted a lot of imagination and time to this project 35 years ago. What's their view on it now with hindsight of 35 years?
That's very interesting. And, of course, that's Eric asked what the people who worked on this, who I went and interviewed, how do they feel about it now? And first of all, my father only worked on it for a year. So the interesting thing was to talk to the people who kept working on it, who really did the engineering and so on. And they, I mean, for all of them, of course, it was the high point of their youth. Southern California in the 50s was fabulous for everybody. And there was this very exciting stuff going on. So they all had tremendous nostalgia for it. They all felt it was a terrible shame it didn't happen then, but nobody wants to do it now. They all know that it's time has passed, unless you read, actually many of them do have an interest in doing it, that there's clean ways you could do it now where you would build these things way off in deep space, possibly, and use up the stockpile. I mean, it's a better, we have 100 tons of plutonium to get rid of now, and the cost goes up every year. We're looking at something like hundreds of billions of dollars to try and get rid of that stuff, and this actually would be a way to get rid of it, but you would have to have a sort of human imagination that we've completely lost to get people. The only people who could do it would be sort of a cult, like the Heaven's Gate people or something. And well, I think, everyone agrees there's better ways to evacuate than Orion. I mean, Orion was, the value of Orion was that in the 50s, it could have got us out there, and we didn't go. And it's a shame we didn't go, and we missed that chance, but it's a chance I don't think that will come back. There's laser propulsion, there's solar electric, there's all sorts of more elegant ways now that we could do the same thing. But there'd be some emergency, and then yes, maybe somebody has to do it. So it's good to keep the plans on file. Yeah, quite a number of the Orion engineers came from the nuclear-powered aircraft project, which was a dismal failure, and they all knew it was going to be a failure, but they worked on it, and this was the idea of a nuclear-powered airplane where you had a reactor on the airplane, and if the coolant system failed, it was game over in 30 seconds. You couldn't land the thing. The idea was it just would keep flying because there would be nowhere you could land it. So it was one of these really crazy 50s. Schemes. There were a number. There were crazier ones than that even. But they.
In the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the implicit assumption is sometimes made that a long with technical civilization will develop some godlike power in every direction. And it seems to me in the history of computation, where you find out 9 or 12 words of magnitude, there's other things like rocketry where we haven't improved that much.
No, I think you're probably right. I mean, that's sort of my view, that rocketry is really almost a dead end. I mean, you just can't, there just isn't the energy source, to move heavy hardware at very high speeds just is beyond, and even if you can't, I mean, that Super Orion, which my father did some studies on, so there, this was sort of taking it to the limit, where you had a ship, there was 8 million tons, and you used megaton hydrogen bombs, and all you're trying to do is get to Alpha Centauri, which is 4 light years, And you can get there in 150 years, and it takes 25 million bombs. And then you're there, but if you want to stop, it takes 25 million more bombs. So that, I think that demonstrates that you know, even with the energy of hydrogen bombs, the interstellar travel is just, it's just things are too far away. It's okay for going to Mars and that sort of thing, but the sort of Star Trek view that, you know, there's going to be galactic, you know, travel cruises, I think is fiction.
Yes.
Yeah, fusion is certainly the hope, but the problem is that we're not even doing it on the ground, let alone in space, and it's going to be much harder to do in space than on the, so fusion hasn't worked yet. If it does, that's a good energy source. The problem with most of these things is that they're low thrust. Orion's really the only thing we still know of that is, you know, is high specific impulse and high thrust. So bombs are actually a very efficient way to burn fuel, and the external combustion is a good system because you're burning it safely away from the ship. But it's just that we have this problem with bombs. If we can become peaceful enough so we don't ever dream of using bombs for weapons, then it's a different picture. But that's a long way off.
Yeah.
The flying models? Well, that's depressing. I mean, you want to, you know, basically 100 meters or 150 meters. But it was an exciting proof of principle that at least the thing moved and it stayed on course. But it was nothing practical at all. Yes, that's partly true. That the question was, why didn't they think about the moon? Mainly just because the moon was too close and too much gravity. It was you'd waste so much time and fuel to stop at the moon, and what for? There was nothing there. It's a dry bunch of rock. Mars was certainly much more interesting, and Jupiter and Saturn were even more interesting. So once you got going, sort of, why stop at the moon?
Sorry, I'll take this.
Presumably, at the same time, somebody in Russia was thinking of going to Jupiter and Mars. Do you know how they were going to do it?
I tried to find that out. Andrei Sakharov, in his memoirs, talks about a meeting when this subject was brought up, and they were quite concerned about Project Orion, and they wanted to do their own. But I never found anyone who actually was working on a similar project. It was a physicist named Vladimir Shmelev who was assigned to monitor Orion. And Ted Taylor met him at a disarmament conference years later, and they were sitting around having drinks or something, and it came up that he had been the guy watching what they were doing. But that was probably what would have saved the project, if they kept looking for evidence that the Russians were doing it. And if evidence had turned up that the Russians were doing it, then I think it would have got the American go-ahead.
Okay, well, maybe one last question, George.
Yes, one more. Well, Hans Bethe was a very strong supporter. He helped at the beginning very tangibly with getting political support. When the people in Congress were saying, this is crazy, we don't want to touch it, he came in and said, no, these, you better support this. Edward Teller, in his own strange way, he helped the thing get started at the beginning, but it was Ulam's idea, and he didn't want it to grow, so he immediately started a Livermore project that he thought was better, and did not help Orion very much. But he was a very strong supporter of Ted and de Hoffman. So in their own way, both Beta and Teller supported this thing, but not, they didn't actually work on it. Thank you.
I'd now like to invite Eric Vogt to come forward and thank our speaker.
It's my privilege tonight to thank George Dyson. This has been one of our continued celebrations of the Dyson family. I first met George when he came out of his tree 30 years ago, and he's become just remarkably articulate. That's perhaps not surprising. His father, Freeman, has given us several of the best lectures the Institute has had. We never had the privilege of hearing George's grandfather, after whom he's named. His grandfather was Sir George Dyson. He was the head of the Royal College of Music in London, and we hear his compositions on the CBC a lot. But Sir George Dyson also wrote books, and the most popular book that he wrote was the book on which sold, I think, hundreds of thousands of copies, on warfare with hand grenades. And so the family was always... You have a copy of it, I believe.
Yeah.
And the talk tonight has also been a celebration of the human imagination. After World War II, when the atomic bomb was accomplished, there was a sense of optimism that, you know, that don't worry about technical problems, we can do anything. And Project Orion perhaps epitomizes some of the optimism that existed at that time. There were pitfalls. We've heard about those today. And I think it's a good thing we didn't dump more pollution, more plutonium into the atmosphere. But it was certainly a time of optimism. I should have also mentioned, for the Dyson family, we have some of the future speakers from that family here tonight. We don't only have George's mother here, we have his daughter, Lauren, who has been here at several meetings and is probably going to speak from now on. We have George's, the brilliant sister, Esther, who has become a cult figure, perhaps the world's dominant guru for computers. And we're just delighted that she could join us here tonight, and we hope that we can invite her back sometime in the future. So the Dyson family has given us pleasure, George. It was a pleasure, all of your slides and the story you've had to tell, and also the humor with which you've given it. Thank you very much on behalf of
the... Thank you.
Just a couple of quick notes. I wanted you to know that the parking, when you come, if the gate's open, is actually free. There were a few people who were paying even though the gate was open. And I just want to assure you, you don't have to pay for parking when you come on Saturday night. The other thing is that please join, if you haven't joined already, the Vancouver Institute. We appreciate your support. Next week, we reconvene to hear Dr. Cochrane from Rome. Please have a safe journey home. Before you leave, there's coffee in the foyer. I think cookies Peter's brought along. Please stay and have a coffee and enjoy each other's company. I'll look forward to seeing you next week. Thank you.